Hello, listeners, book lovers, and friends. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Holly Payne, the host and producer of Page One, a podcast that celebrates the stories and craft that go into writing the first sentence, first paragraph, and first page of a book. Why create a podcast about the first page? Well, all master storytellers have a secret. Their first page is often their most rewritten page because it has to work so hard to achieve so much, hooking the reader, maybe hooking you. And for those of us intrigued by how master storytellers work their magic, I thought it'd be a lot of fun to talk to the world's most beloved authors about the craft. Today on episode 12, we have the honor of talking with award-winning novelist Erica Ferencik about her latest thriller, Girl in Ice, published March 1st by Scout Press, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. Ferencik is also known for taking readers on journeys to remote places and challenging herself with firsthand research, which we'll discuss in more detail today. Those adventures inspired her other two novels, The River at Night and Into the Jungle, which feature Erica's hallmark badass women protagonists. In addition to writing novels, Erica Ferencik's writing career spans 35 years and includes short stories, essays, ghostwriting, screenplays, a brief stint in filmmaking, and a decade of stand-up and sketch comedy, which we'll also get into later on this episode. Ferencik's work has appeared in Salon Magazine, the Boston Globe, and on NPR, and she holds an MFA in creative writing from Boston University. You can find her online at ericaferencik.com and follow her on Twitter at ericaferencik, which you can also find on the episode notes. And if you're curious about the spelling, it's Erica, E-R-I-C-A, Ferencik, F-E-R-E-N-C-I-K. Again, you can find that on the episode notes. Erica Ferencik, welcome to Page One.
Thanks so much, Holly. Thank you for being so brave with my name.
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, my God, my name. Hey, you know.
Thank you for holding the hand on that one.
That's okay.
It's such a delight to have you here with us today.
I'm honored to be here, Holly.
Well,
I'm really excited.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I'm nervous, but excited, you know.
Hey, you know, we talked about that. We're all right. Nervous on these, and I go to the bathroom about 35 times before a podcast interview. So I'm glad we're on par with that. But I know our listeners are eager to travel with you. So let's jump into your latest novel, Girl in Ice, which is now available in bookstores, library, and of course on Amazon. And because we avoid all spoilers on Page One, I'm going to share the book summary with our listeners, if that's okay with you.
Oh, sure.
They can find that anywhere. So right. Valerie, Val Chesterfield, is a linguist trained in the most esoteric of disciplines, dead Nordic languages. Despite her successful career, she leads a sheltered life and languishes in the shadow of her twin brother, Andy, an accomplished climate scientist stationed on a remote island off Greenland's barren coast. But Andy is gone, a victim of suicide, having willfully ventured unprotected into 50 degree below zero weather. Val is inconsolable and disbelieving. She suspects foul play. When Wyatt, Andy's fellow researcher in the Arctic, discovers a scientific impossibility, a young girl frozen in the ice who thaws out alive, speaking a language no one understands, Val is his first call. Will she travel to the frozen north to meet this girl and try to comprehend what she is so passionately trying to communicate? Under the auspices of helping Wyatt interpret the girl's speech, Val musters every ounce of her courage and journeys to the Arctic to solve the mystery of her brother's death. Okay, I love to travel and I love stories that take me to places I've never been. So let's go on this journey to Greenland. Will you go ahead and please read the first manuscript page?
Of course, of course. Seeing the name Wyatt Speaks in my inbox hit me like a physical blow. Everything rushed back, the devastating phone call, the disbelief, the image of my brother's frozen body in the Arctic wasteland. I shut my laptop, pasted a weak smile on my face. There would be no bursting into tears at school. Grief was for after hours, for the nightly bottle of Merlot from my dark apartment, for waking on the couch at dawn, the blue light of the TV caressing my aching flesh. No, at the moment, my job was to focus on the fresh, eager face of my graduate student as she petitioned for a semester in Tibet, a project in a tiny village deep in the Himalayas, accessible only via treacherous mountain passes on foot and maybe llama, all to decipher a newly discovered language. As I listened to her impassioned plea, trying to harness my racing heart, an old shame suffused me. The truth was, I'd never embarked into the field, any place more frightening than a local graveyard, to suss out a bit of old English carved into a crumbling stone marker. And even then, I made sure to go in broad daylight because dead people, even underground, frightened me too. Never had my curiosity about a place or a language and its people overridden my just say no reflex. Citing schedule conflicts, I declined a plum semester-long gig in the Andean mountains of Peru to study quipu, or talking knots, cotton strings of differing lengths tied to a cord, carried from village to village by runners, each variation in the string signaling municipal facts, taxes paid or owed, births and deaths, notices of famine, drought, crop failure, plague, and so on. I'd even passed on the once-in-a-lifetime chance to deconstruct the language carved into the 2,000-year-old Longyu Caves in Kuzhou, China. Why? Anxiety, the crippling kind.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am so excited to jump in here. And I know in all these other prior episodes, we get to hear about the struggles of just nailing down these first sentences and first paragraphs. Can you speak to any struggle you had getting this just right for Girl in Ice?
Oh, I don't know. I wrote it like 50 times. And also, I think I started out at different places in the story. And I thought, well, this will be like a flashback. I didn't know whether to start with the brother's death. I think I started the story that way. As you say, I had to cram so much in there and yet leave the reader something to do, some kind of hook. And actually, the first iteration of the book, I made her practically agoraphobic, which I thought I had to dial back on that just for various plot reasons. Right. I do have a lot of trouble with beginnings, and I have trouble with endings too, but that's a whole other. Because not to get off track of the first page thing, but I was just writing about this today. You know, well, the question was, what are the most difficult scenes to write? I said, absolutely the first page. How can you hook someone in whatever 300 words and say what, where, when, why, how, and then a hook without doing a big info dump and saying enough so that they want to read more, but not too much that they feel like, oh, I've read the story 50 times before. And I was just thinking to answer that question about scenes today, I really have trouble with the last scene because I'm so busy getting to the climax, you know, and all this buildup, and then the resolution is difficult because I don't know where to leave the reader sometimes. I don't know how it's difficult to feel sometimes for me, how much to leave to the reader to taffy out on their own or whether to spell it out. So anyway, that's just today's conundrum, like those kinds of scenes.
Well, that's great. I want to talk about that later when we, if we have time, about endings, because I think it's so interesting in terms of bookends. And I'm going to confess something, and I hope listeners don't think any less of me or judge me for this really bad habit. But because I love story architecture and I absolutely just see the design right from the outset, I have to see the beginning, the first page, and I look at the last page.
Oh, no, don't tell me. Oh, my God. I'm never going to speak to you again.
I know. It's a horrible confession, but the reason I do it is because I say, okay, what are they doing in this first page? And do I feel, it's almost like, what's the note at the end and what's the opening? What are the opening first chords? And I'm like, oh, my God. And if I see it, if I see the dovetail immediately, I'm like, oh my God, now I want to know how they put it all together, right? And usually it doesn't really spoil anything. It's more of just understanding the tone and just, it's always a curiosity for me. So yes.
I'm glad that you're reading the last page piques your curiosity as opposed to killing it.
No.
As long as you still want to read the book.
No, it only piques my curiosity and I don't allow myself to read anything more. In fact, I usually only read the last paragraph because it's something musical for me. I'm like, okay, how did it start? How did it end? So with
it
yours, so you say you wrote this 50 pages, the first page of Girl in Ice.
Oh, at least, and you know, my editor, she tries to be gentle, but she had a point each and every, I'm saying at least a dozen times. The first 6 times I was like, where in the story do I start? And then I realized the reason I was doing it was because I didn't know the story well enough, you know? Mm. And I think if you know your story, I mean, people say, oh, you know, you go to the Arctic, go to the jungles of Peru, you go to the Allagash territory of Northern Maine to get ideas. I don't go to get ideas. I have a first draft before I leave.
Interesting. Okay.
Because we've talked about this. I know you're a big researcher as well. And I just get overwhelmed when I'm out there. The world's too fascinating and beautiful. And I lose track of what I even want. It's like, I need to know who to talk to, who to interview and why. What am I looking for? You know, what details in the story do I need? What do I need to verify? I mean, what is it that, why am I here? You know, if I just need to feel it, see it, sense it, that's great too. And I did that in Greenland. That was just, I mean, you read about a place and then you go there.
I think it's a really interesting comment that you drew, the conclusion that you drew. Yeah. After, I think, 6 drafts. And then she said in that very gentle way that editors who are great, right? And they have to, unfortunately, deliver the medicine, right? It's like, here's the diagnosis. But when it hits like that and it lands so well, because it's so true, it's like, oh, that's right. We struggle as authors when we don't know the story. And so sometimes you have to keep writing your way through it to know it.
Yeah.
And so I think that's great for anyone who's listening, who is in the middle of their novel and is laying in these first drafts, right? Which is any number of drafts that get you to kind of an understanding of the story. Then you can start to navigate the terrain of like, what
then is... Then it'll come to you. It'll be so clear. And you'll be like, why didn't I think of that? And can I talk about a quick pet peeve I have about drafts?
Yes, please.
Oh my God. So there is the philosophy of, you know, you just barf out the first draft. I did a lot of barfing of first drafts and it got me nowhere. And there's also people talk about writer's block, but writing is thinking. That's all it is. Making the words is later. I mean, I get an idea. I get ideas, several ideas a week for books. And I go to bed one night and I'll just feel, this is the best idea I've ever had. And then I wake up, that's the stupidest idea. Please just flush that one away. So it's really important for me to vet an idea to death and also realize you're going to live with it if you choose it for years. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
You better love it so much, you know?
Yeah. So Erica, let's peel that back a second. You just said really is fascinating to me because I think this is in the creative process. Many people get pinged with an idea and then they wake up the next morning and they think it's terrible or something about it is terrible. So what is happening for you to determine that it's terrible?
And what a great question.
And then how do you discern which is the one that you're going to live with for years, as you just said?
Yeah. Well, and I say live with for years because you have to write it, then hopefully it gets published, and then you talk about it, you know, like ad nauseum. I'm not complaining. It's just like you have to love it so much, you know. So I think what happens is you realize that's not the story for me to write. And it's not that I can't do the research or know enough about the world. I just don't, it's not something that I'd have to just change myself too much as a writer to write it. Like you could admire, like, aren't there books that you just love so, so much? And you, I mean, I have just had fantasies of, if I could just write a book like that. You're never going to write a book like that. You know, you're only going to write a book like you can write. And this sort of, and I will answer your question, but this sort of goes into, you know, the editorial process and you get your notes back from your beta readers. And yes, I think it's 100% important to think about what everyone says. However, you have to vet it. Like, who is saying what to you? What do they like to read? What is it about them that you can sort of factor in their comments? And you do reach a point where you dial back to that little kernel of yourself that just is the thing that got you in trouble in the first place in this business. And that is this belief in that you have something to say that is of value to your reader. And if you lose that, that's not good. But you wouldn't be this far listeners, I think passionate readers and writers, if you didn't think and believe that there was something really important to say. And to answer your question, I'm sorry, how do you know it's not for you? You just wake up and you're not feeling it. It's almost like a relationship.
Well, yes.
And you know what I mean?
I know. And this is what I want to get to.
I liked him because I was drunk, you know?
Yeah. So now let me ask it in the reverse, right? How do you know it's for you? How do you know the idea is going to work?
Well, you wake up the next day and you don't hate it. You actually like it a little more, but you don't want to admit it to yourself. Then maybe you start doing some research about it. Then characters pop into your head and scenes. I'm very visual. I was a visual art. I was a painter till I was 26. And I woke up one day, I said, I want to be a writer. It was that literal. It was that overnight. It was a really strange day.
Well, that is actually very interesting because I didn't know that about you. And it makes absolute sense for anyone who is just beginning to be familiar with Erica Ferencik's work. You take us in these worlds and you paint so vividly the world. And I'm going to get into that
in a
second. But I just want to backtrack for 1 second here.
Sure, of course.
Because you're getting to something that's really fascinating. And that is like the way that we discard the ideas that we say they're not going to work.
Yeah.
And can I wager, and my sense here of what you're saying and what maybe is the subtext of all this is you have to love it. And there's an emotional connection that you
so
have.
True.
So I want to talk to you about that because in your first sentence here, you have this last clause and you say the last sentence is everything rushed back, the devastating phone call, the disbelief, the image of my brother's frozen body in the Arctic wasteland. Now, I found this fascinating because the title of the book is Girl in Ice.
Yes.
And I thought this was brilliant on your behalf that the second sentence gives us an image of the protagonist's brother frozen in ice. And so I wasn't sure as I began this book, and I'm not giving away anything.
No.
I wasn't sure who is in the image of the cover. I'm thinking, does the protagonist actually die in search of this or avenging her brother's death or however the story was going to go? So I just found it really interesting because there's this psychological thing going for a reader. They see the cover, they have the title, Girl in Ice. And then that last clause is the image of my brother's frozen body in the Arctic wasteland. And I want you to speak to us about that because there's so much amazing imagery in your work and you really do create this unbelievably imaginative world for us. On top of that too, even though you're dealing with a lot of scientists, there's so much emotion here and there's so much subtext through the entire book, but I want to get to the subtext that you're bringing in right now because it's doing its little thing. The little talons are coming out, right? And they're just starting to scratch at us as readers. And you do it right there. That very first one, you get this email. It hit me like a physical blow. We all have had that experience of seeing something come to us. And then, so now you bring me in into a way to relate to what's happening. And the next sentence, I say, oh my God, she lost her brother. And I see him frozen and I have that horrible image of a body frozen in ice in front of me. And yet it's not matching the cover of the book.
Yeah, I know. I never thought of that. I was like, here I am talking about her brother freezing to death. It's really funny. Like that sentence, I was kind of pissed at my editor because she kept saying, this isn't working. I'm not being pulled in. I'm not being pulled in. I said to myself, well, I'm going to write the most terrifying first sentence I can possibly think of. And that was it.
That's
you know,
great.
And I did it because I was pissed. I was like, and I said to myself, and it's going to be really over the top and stupid. And so then I wrote it. I was like, that's not bad.
That's right. That's like, I mean, an editor. Bad. Yeah. And that's an editor pushing you to your absolute greatest, right?
And you know how like, you just do not want to open the notes. You don't. You're like,
yeah.
Oh my God. And so.
Well, thank God for the note, right?
Thank God for the note. Thank God for the note. Right. And then I just thought of something about the story idea, what it needs. What it needs is depth. It needs, it has to work on lots of different layers. I mean, some little story ideas are good for, not to denigrate short stories because they can be incredibly complex and layered, but it has to have legs. You know, it has to be something that can be turned into 300 pages is a lot to ask of an idea.
Yeah. Well, I think
a lot to
It is. It's a big burden. And in your work specifically, not only the hallmark of creating these incredibly strong female protagonists, otherwise, as I introduced, these badass protagonists, which I'm so excited to talk about, but really, I think the hookiness for your work, Erica, is the world, the worlds that you create. And so one of the questions I wanted to ask you is character, plot, place, in which order? Mm-hmm. What does it come to you in terms of these ideas where, or is it a combination of both and or all three of those? But I am curious, like you say that you have to write a draft and then you take that to do the diligence of the world that you're creating. And
before I go on the research trips.
Right. But when you're coming up with the idea, because part of the hook for the reader is going to be part of the idea itself, right? Of the entire book. So we have the hook in the first page, but you have the hook and concept of the book to begin with. What is it that draws you first? Are you more character? Is it more place, or is it plot?
I think it's human emotion that is dressed with plot. And then with a setting, which becomes a character, I can talk about my three different books and how they were born for sure. But I guess I'll talk about Girl on Ice. Two things. The first thing, I've been carrying an image in my mind for 40 years. And that image is from the 1931 black and white version of Frankenstein. And there's a scene toward the end of that movie. And I'm not saying that Frankenstein is in Girl on Ice at all. I mean, I'm just saying it's an image. But there's a scene where Frankenstein's monster has been bloodied and hunted, and he's disgusted and he's in despair, and he's given up on humanity. And in the scene, he's walking into an Arctic setting, and this blizzard is blowing all around this blocky black silhouette. And it just starts to erase him. And this white just ravenously erases him. And I've just been devastated by that image my whole life. But I'm still parsing why. I think it has to do with man's inhumanity to human variety, I guess. That sort of started to fascinate me even when I was little with the Arctic. Look at the shapes water takes. Look at it. I mean, when I was in Greenland, I was kayaking among these 15-story tall icebergs that were shaped by wind and waves into these weird. Some, they looked like monsters or cathedrals or all kinds of stuff. So that was an image, the Frankenstein image. But the day I got the idea, I was walking behind my house in the woods and by this frozen pond, and I saw three juvenile painted turtles mid-stroke in the pond, just like about to take a stroke, but they were frozen in there. And I was like, they don't look alive, but they don't look dead either. So I ran home and I Googled all these things that could freeze and thaw out alive. And it turns out there's a list of them that can. Alligators, iguanas in Florida, I think we talked about that. Certain kinds of beetle, caterpillar, and lots of Arctic creatures can do that. And I thought, well, why not a girl? Why not a girl? And what would be her story? And what would be her backstory? And why would she thaw out alive? Because, you know, we can't do that. We don't have cryoproteins in our body that these animals possess, which gives them that ability. Although they have thawed out 100,000-year-old lichen and moss and put it under lights and warmth and it's sprouted.
You're listening to the Page One podcast that celebrates the first sentence, first paragraph, and first page of a book. I'm Holly Payne, your host and producer, and I interview master storytellers about the struggles and stories that go into writing the first page of their books. As the author of four novels and a writing coach, I know that the first page of any book has to work so hard to do so much, hook the reader. So I thought to ask your favorite master storytellers how they do their magic to hook you. I started the podcast this past spring, and after the first few episodes, it occurred to me that maybe someone listening might be curious about how their first page sits with an audience. Writing takes courage, and courage needs a community. So I'm opening up the podcast to any writer who wants to submit the first page of a book they're currently writing. If your page is chosen, you'll be invited onto the show to read it and get live feedback from one of Page One's master storytellers, I'm so excited about this. I love when there's a chance for a new author to get discovered. And Page One exists to inspire, celebrate, and promote the work of both a known and unknown creative talent. Maybe that's you. If this excites you, please submit your page at hollylynnpayne.com/community. That's Holly Lynn Payne, HollyLynnPayne.com/community. And now back to the show. You're a painter, right? You're haunted by this image of Frankenstein. You've brought this image with you. Let's talk for a second about who it is that you're setting up that's going to carry this story forward. Just want to get into the third paragraph, actually the fourth one. You set up that obviously her brother has been killed in this first page and his body's frozen in an Arctic wasteland. And then she has this opportunity come to her that she could maybe do this, but you get the sense that she's pushed back on anything in her past. And then you say, the truth was, I'd never embarked into the field any place more frightening than a local graveyard to suss out a bit of old English carved into a crumbling stone marker. And then you have this great phrase, you say that never had my curiosity about a place or language and its people overridden my just say no reflex. And you're telling it through a first person of a character that you've created. How much of you is in her? Have you had any of this incredible terror, and how have you overcome it to do your research? I am really curious, like how much of this is inspired by your own, maybe not agoraphobia, right? Or is it inspired by your need to flesh out all the details of the world that you're writing about?
So the way I relate to Val is that I have my anxieties, but they're not about leaving the house. I love travel. I am not afraid at all. That said, to go into the jungle for a month, to go to Greenland, there's so many words for fear. Apprehension. Second thoughts, especially. I almost didn't go on the jungle trip. They're just because being the person I am, I had to read dozens of books about the jungle. You want to scare the shit out of yourself? You know, read about what can eat you down there. I mean, including plants. So I had to get over a lot of my own fear going on these trips, and each trip taught me something about fear, which I can talk about if you would like, but I feel that I am not Val, and it was kind of tricky to write someone who had this anxiety, but also went on the trip, you know, and I had to just kind of toe that line a little bit. Like, I couldn't make her so terrified that she didn't leave the means she had to go. That was the whole story, right? You know?
Right.
So that was a hard line to toe. That's why I went from, you know, pure agoraphobia to she needs some pills. She needs some booze. She needs to just... But she needs the pills to really function. I think the thing that I learned with The River at Night, was my debut. It was about four women who go whitewater rafting in the Allagash territory of Northern Maine. They lose the raft and they have to survive not only the wilderness, but a mother and son who have disappeared themselves for their own tragic reasons. So for that, I thought, okay, I've never spoken to anyone who lives off the grid. I have to. People ask me, you know, why do you actually go into the field for research? And it's because I think that writing a novel, writing a book is an act of love. And it is my gesture of love to the world. It's what I got. I'm a bad cook. I don't have children of my own. What I can do is write stories. Sometimes they're pretty good, sometimes they're not, but I know a way to make them better is to actually do the research and get the authentic stuff. So I called back to The River at Night, looking for people who live off the grid. I called, oh my God, every town right up to North Kent. I called the Chamber of Commerce. Do you know anyone who lives off the grid? And they're like, yeah, but they don't want to talk to you. They live off the grid. You know, they don't want to speak to you. But I eventually lined up interviews with five men. Yeah, I'm talking about lone men living out there and two families. And I won't talk too much more about it, but I just learned so much about human nature. I learned to trust my gut about human nature. That's the kind of fear. And I think fear is this big sloppy word. It just encompasses so many things. But I learned to trust my process of interviewing, and I learned to trust my instincts about people. because, you know, I didn't want to get disappeared myself, you know. But in the jungle, can I talk about what I learned in the jungle?
Absolutely.
Of interest.
I mean, I'm really curious too of how you brought all that to the research that you did in Greenland.
Yeah. Well, going into the jungle, I didn't know how to be in the jungle. I had a guide, and the first couple of days, all I did was talk at him. Like, I talked and talked and talked, and I wasn't close enough to him. Anyway, I sort of held back to take pictures. In any case, he said, Erica, like second day, he's like, you really need to stop talking. And I said, why? And he said, well, because I'm listening. I said, what are you listening? And he said, well, right now I know that there's a troop of 36 TT monkeys coming toward us. They're about a mile away, and we are going to be visited really soon. And I said, how can you tell that? He said, because I'm listening, you know, and I'm quiet. And so literally by the time I left, so he said, you have to listen and you have to use all your senses and have a 360 degree awareness of your surroundings. This was for survival. This was to stay safe. I mean, he could hear with his feet. He heard a group. He said, okay, we have to find shelter really soon. We have to, you know, get behind one of these giant lupuna trees. Lupuna trees are these massive, massive trees. They're like as wide as two school buses. And I said, why? He said, because there's a troop of white peccary, which is kind of pig, coming. They're about half a mile away. We need to get behind this tree. And they came, and they would have run us over, but they kind of flowed around this tree as we were in its root system. And so all that taught me that I went from fear to just this sort of ecstatic awareness. It was ecstatic. It was felt beautiful. It felt like nothing you need to really learn when you're in your house and everything is climate controlled, and it's nothing we're used to turning on, but we can turn it on. We can turn it on. We all have it. It's that sense of, you know, you feel like something's wrong, or you feel you go outside and maybe you, I don't know, it's, we all have it. And in Greenland, I was a little bit like Val in the sense of, it was so enormous. I mean, this island, it's the largest island in the world. It's 1500 miles from north to south, 700 miles east to west. The ice cap is 600,000 square miles of ice. It's 2 miles deep at its deepest. And so and it's important to remember that only 56,000 people live there. That is 1/10 the population of Wyoming. That's like a small community college, right? So there is no one around. I mean, there are these tiny villages with like 150 people, way, way, way out, that the main thing is subsistence hunting and fishing. And wow, it's one thing to read about that, and it's another thing to witness that someone's got to hunt and fish to feed their kids and themselves and their town. But a crossover between the jungle and Greenland is everyone was taking care of each other. You know, nobody was going hungry. In the jungle, there were all these dugout canoes lying around, and if someone didn't have dinner, someone in the community would just jump in the boat and go fishing. And that was beautiful too. That was hard to leave.
How long were you in Greenland for this particular research?
3 weeks with a couple of days either, and I was in Iceland for a while, around 3 weeks. So it was from August of 2019 to September of 2019.
Wow, right before the
just
pandemic.
Before, I know, so lucky. Yeah. Oh my
yeah.
God.
Well, and it allowed you to probably do lots of drafts during the pandemic.
Yeah. 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 Didn't affect my deadlines.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I want to circle back a little bit. We talked about fear, and then this is segueing into something that I would love for our readers to know. When I was introducing Erica, but she has spent 10 years in stand-up and sketch comedy.
Yeah.
And so I was reading the piece that you have about the influence of this on your work. What comedy taught you, you say, is the power of observation. And what you've just described in this research and going to these far-flung places, I don't know of a lot of authors who actually eagerly sign up for going to the world that they're creating, but you're doing both. You're allowing your imagination to create it, but then you're verifying it through the research and getting all those extra details and then having the somatic experience in the way that your guide in the Peruvian jungle on that research trip. But it's helping you build kind of your courage muscles. But yeah. I want to ask.
And we're all so much braver than we think we are, you know?
Yeah.
You're all brave out there, folks, just so you know. And really. You got it. It's done.
You're unique, Erica, because you have not many people and not many authors put themselves up for doing stand-up comedy, let alone for 10 years. How did comedy build your courage muscles and give you that courage when, you say comedy, you've written comedy is the angry art.
Yeah.
It sounds like the first several books that you wrote, which you talked to me about, you said you had to write several, nine, I don't know how many books you wrote until you wrote the book that quote unquote someone wanted is what you had said to me earlier in the week.
Yeah.
And how can comedy, especially as another way for authors or aspiring authors, build up the courage, or how did it do that for you? Because the whole thrust of it was for you to kind of get out your anger and disappointment about the books you had written up to that point.
So we're dialing back into my, late 20s. I'd written a couple of books that were really bad. I was really frustrated. And I thought, well, I'm kind of funny. Maybe I'll do stand up. So I tried it and I liked it and I started getting paid for it. I was always working full time. I always had like five jobs, but I had very mixed feelings about it. Very love hate. It's a brutal thing to do. You are up there and you are just asking people to laugh. And when people laugh, that's a loss of control. And people don't like to lose control. They say they do. They go to comedy to laugh, but it's like a challenge. They're like, yeah, make me laugh, sure. I really worked on my bravery muscles for 10 years, like three nights a week for 10 years. There was something about it. I had to fight a thing in myself. I had to fight self-doubt. Even if I just get on stage and just fight it for tonight, that's what I want to do. Comedy is a great teacher. It forces you to observe. Otherwise, you won't have any jokes. You have to talk about something. It forced me to write constantly and to vet material, which is really important for a writer to do. I'm constantly vetting ideas, constantly coming up with new ideas. And it took me the longest time to learn that comedy is a conversation between the comic and the audience. And that's not so obvious to me now. Is it obvious to you?
No, but when you say it like that, it is obvious because you think of the comedians out there who you do feel involved, but not in a way that I always cringe when the comedian like stares at you in the, I want to hide. I don't want to be.
I want to hide. Jumps in front. No. But I mean, it took me a while to learn that it is a conversation. So you say a punchline and I used to just be afraid that they wouldn't laugh. So I would start on the next joke. Well, you have to wait. You have to say the punchline. And I think the most terrifying 10 seconds in the world is waiting for the human beings to react to what you've said. Silence is horrible. Laughter is great, but it's not always laughter. Obviously, you have to figure out, okay, what if, all the way down the line. That's a bravery muscle right there. And once I learned that I had to do that, it became kind of fun, weirdly. It's like I took back the power because I was waiting and I was said, okay, well, whatever happens, I'm just going to deal with it instead of being afraid and just talking, hoping someone would interrupt me with laughter. That's just not how it is. And you'll notice that with really good comedians, they'll tell a joke and they'll wait. And there's like this wave, of reaction, and they'll just let it happen because they'll have script A, B, or C dependent on the reaction. But unless you can be strong enough to do that, then they'll eat you alive. They'll sense it's disrespectful. you're not talking to them as if they're human beings and can react. Then they'll think, oh, maybe she doesn't even think she's funny. Well, I don't think she's funny either. Oh, it gets horrible. But it was quite a learning experience. I worked with famous people and it was kind of wonderful. And
how much of all of that training did you bring into your work as a novelist?
A joke rests on a word. It can rest on a syllable and the intonation of a syllable and the spaces between the pause, when you pause in a sentence. You know, Wendy Liebman is a stand-up who will say a joke and you think she's done, and then she'll say the real punchline. Anyway, it's terrific. That's her style. But I guess what I learned was what's part of the joke and what's not part of the joke. Just the same with my writing of these novels. What's part of the story and what's not part of the story? And the discipline there is, what's your story? And I think every writer, what is the story? Every writer should have a little, you know, post-it on top of their computer that says, what is my story? Or I don't know what the post-it should say exactly, but once you've got your, it's like sculpture. So you're making a sculpture, pare away what's not part of your story. And the way you know your story is you've got to think about it. Don't do endless drafts, in my opinion. Okay, so I come up with an idea and I write it, you know, maybe a couple pages with the three act structure. I'm very traditional that way. And then I taffy it out, out and out and out. And I spend close to 3 months writing an outline. I think novels are way too complicated to trust to just writing. And it's okay to think about your novel. It's okay to think about it more than you write it. Then when I have the, you know, this 100-page outline, writing it, okay, I got it now. I know what needs to happen when. I know who these people are. I'm not going to waste time on endless drafts. We only have one life. Let's not spend it. If your goal is a nice tight novel, don't spend it writing for hours and hours and hours, unless that's part of your process. I mean, you know, that said, a scene would come to me or a detail would come to me, and just be organized with your notes. Start a bunch of different folders that contain ideas or whatever it is. And you need to be able to retrieve things. I mean, I think some people use software. I make my own retrieval. I think retrieval is incredibly important. Like, where was that idea?
So when you're doing these outlines and you're spending 3 months in kind of that story development phase, is it just bulleted stuff or are you going deep in the details?
I'm going deep in the details and I am envisioning what happens in great detail. Some people do it beautifully. I don't know how they do it. They do it without an outline, but it's like building a house without a blueprint. And suddenly you have a pile of windows and then you don't know where they're. It is incredibly complex writing a novel. But during the process, I don't deny myself the joy of when I come up with something. I always, as I'm writing, come up with stuff. So I do think the physical act of writing is incredibly important. What's really important is sitting your butt down and letting yourself, shutting out the world or whatever you do, and give yourself that time. And if you really want to write a book, you got to make it a part of your schedule.
What are you reading recently that hooked you? And would you read the first page and share the title and the author's name so everyone gets a chance to hear what's dazzling you at the moment?
I've got The Push by Ashley O'Drain, which is like a brilliant sort of reimagining of the bad seed, you know, the bad seed concept. I read that a few months ago. I can't get it out of my head. An older book, Enduring Love by Ian McEwan. Absolutely fabulous thriller about obsession. The Woman Upstairs, again, a little bit older book. I guess I'm into obsession. Another book that really addresses obsession. And a new book, a couple months old, Bath House. House is spelled H-A-U-S by P.J. Vernon. And I'm loving it. It's about a guy who goes to a bathhouse and encounters someone who pursues him relentlessly. Anyway, so I'm trying to think which one to read. The first page of, right?
Yeah, just first paragraph. I'm curious.
Oh, first paragraph. Okay. Wait, hold on. Can I swear?
Yeah, yeah. Which
in the book.
Okay, which Which book are you going to read out of?
I'm going to read The Woman Upstairs by Claire Massoud.
Okay.
She says, "How angry am I? You don't want to know. Nobody wants to know about that. I'm a good girl. I'm a nice girl. I'm a straight A, straight laced, good daughter, good career girl. And I never stole anybody's boyfriend, and I never ran out on a girlfriend, and I put up with my parents' shit and my brother's shit, and I'm not a girl anyhow. I'm over 40 fucking years old, and I'm good at my job, and I'm great with kids, and I held my mother's hand when she died after 4 years of holding her hand while she was dying, and I speak to my father every day on the telephone, every day, mind you. And what kind of weather do you have on your side of the river? Because here it's pretty gray and a bit muggy too. It was supposed to say great artist on my tombstone, but if I died right now, it would say such a good teacher slash daughter slash friend instead. And what I really want to shout and want in big letters on that grave to say is fuck you all."
And there's the comedian,
another
right?
Another one. I didn't remember that many sucks.
Oh
in
my
there,
gosh. But that is funny. I'm actually really intrigued. Thank you so much for sharing that and spending time with me today. Your work is extremely riveting. I encourage everyone out there to check out Girl in Ice. My daughter grabbed it from me. She's now starting to peruse my podcast books, and she grabbed it and read it in 3 days. And
whoa, you know, I like that kid.
Yeah, she was very, very intrigued. So congratulations on this publication.
Thank you.
I look to read, I'm looking forward to reading more of your work in the future. And thank you for encouraging us to go out and have experiences that challenge us and build our courage muscle so that we can bring great beauty back into the world of other people.
We're citizens of the world, all of us.
Absolutely.
And we have the right to go out into the world, and don't be afraid. I was afraid of going to Peru, and it was like, well, they're all alive, you know?
Yeah, and as an author, you can live as a global citizen, right? And just
Absolutely.
Be a diplomat
Absolutely.
For humanity's sake, you know? You're observing the human condition, and thank you
Absolutely.
For observing it so acutely in Greenland. It's an incredible piece of literature. I hope everyone enjoys it.
Thank you, Holly.
Thank you. You've been listening to Page One, a podcast that celebrates the first sentence, first paragraph, and first page of a book. I'm the host and producer, Holly Payne, and I interview master storytellers about the struggles and stories that go into writing the first page of their latest book. If you're an aspiring writer or a book lover curious about how stories are made, the Page One podcast offers inspiration, wisdom, and some tips of the trade from the world's greatest authors. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I can't wait for you to tune into the next one. If you like Page One, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Pandora, Spotify, or any of your favorite podcast players. And please share this episode with your friends and family. Until then, keep writing. The world needs your stories. And keep reading. Books are medicine for the soul. I hope Page One helps you discover something you'll love too. If you want to learn more about my writing coaching or books, you can find me at hollylynnpayne.com or on Twitter and Instagram at hollylynnpayne. That's hollylynnpayne, hollylynnpayne.com. Thank you.